Cricklewood, Cricklewood, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran, the columns of Alan Corran. Part 3, Away From It All.
While I yield to no one in my admiration either for medical science or for the industries which convert its unflagging research into tubes, phials, tins, jars, boxes and bubble packs, there's no question but that their insistence on constant breakthroughs makes the prospect of each succeeding holiday exponentially glummer. Between your last trip and your next, they will invariably have come up with something new, and you will not only have to take it with you, you will have to confront the prospect of the suffering which will require you to unscrew it. Once upon a time, and not so long ago at that, the travelling Briton was quite prepared to enter abroad with nothing more prophylactic than a stout walking stick and a red-spotted bandana. It was all there was. Finding himself, say, in a noxious spot where the natives were dropping like flies, not to say because of them, the Briton would use the stick both to fend off anybody who might be falling towards him and to negotiate his passage over those who had already fallen, while holding the bandana over his face to filter whatever it was that was felling them. Alternatively, were he to sustain a fracture, it would be the matter of a moment to snap the stick into splints and convert the bandana into a sling, or, in the event of a gash from tusk or kris, a tourniquet. He would then press on regardless, while things healed. The better sticks were hollow and contained whiskey, but this was his only medicinal concession, reserved for that occasional moment when he contracted something from, say, a dodgy Ganges oyster, or a suppurating Baluchi he might inadvertently have rubbed up against in the camel queue, and he had to go and lie down until the fever broke. He did not let this spoil his holiday. Even more important, he did not let its possibility spoil his anticipation of his holiday. Since there was nothing he could do about anything, there was no point worrying. That he might catch malaria while pottering the alien bogs didn't cross his mind. Until, that is, word got out about quinine, he then began to fret. He felt he ought to take precautions. He bought a bottle. I have just got back from the pharmacist. I have 19 packets. I have piriton and antihistamine, and sodium hypochlorite and lomotil, and codeine, and flagyl, and pseudoephedrine, and chlorimazole, and chloramphenicol, and dextropropoxifene, and benzocaine, and acromycin, and diethyl toluamide. And some of them you swallow, and some you smear on, and some you spray, and some you inhale. And I am only going to France. The last time I went, I had a mere 17 packets. But today the pharmacist said there was a lot of something or other about, and there were these new things on the market, so I bought them. He also inquired whether I had considered taking a plasma pack, since you couldn't trust foreign blood transfusions these days. And I thought, oh good, something new to worry about. I wonder if he's got any off-the-peg artificial hips. I bet French orthopaedics are a bit iffy, but I was up to 30 quid already. All very sad. I'm not a hypochondriac, and for the rest of the year I wait for something to go wrong before researching a cure. But here I am, forced to contemplate the 1,000 natural shocks that flesh is heir to, and even worse, gloomily wondering if there's 1,001st I may have missed. Suppose I got beriberi. Suppose a goiter came up, or a wen. Suppose I woke up deaf. Would it be smart to get something for it now, rather than face some ghastly Gallic quack in a wine-stained goatee advancing upon me with a fistful of mildewed suppositories? But at which point to stop? I ask only because of a handy tip I have just spotted in the Daily Telegraph. If a sea urchin spine becomes embedded in your skin while bathing, bandage a pawpaw or pineapple over it. The fruit's enzymes open up the skin, making removal easy. Pity I didn't notice it earlier. The greengrocer's is bang next door to the chemist's.
A star is born.
I may enroll in RADA when I get home. Nothing major, you understand. None of that speaking from the diaphragm stuff, or how to get the audience on your side when poking your eyes out. Nor is milking maximum yucks from hobbling through French windows with my trousers down my ambition. What I'm after is a crash course in thespian trimmings. I need a convincing yawn, an eye-catching stretch, a fetching smirk, an authentic loll, what might be called interesting sitting. I do not need the walk, I have the walk. Admittedly, it owes not a little to John Wayne, but it's none the worse for that, and after all, someone had to pick up the fallen torch. Yesterday I did his slow turn, pinched it straight out of the searchers, How could I not? I was framed in an archway with the sun behind me. I kinked a hip, dropped a shoulder, turned, and ambled into the sunlight. It will be on your screens any day now. Try to catch it, if you live in Düsseldorf. The director was an extremely nice chap. As a humble extra, I don't often meet my directors, but this one gave me his card. No fee, mind, but these are early days, and it was, after all, a pretty informal commission. Shall I get out of the way, I said, and he said, 999, indeed. Would I mind walking through the archway slowly, if that was all right? It's perfectly all right, I replied, and I did the thing with the hip and the shoulder, and it was a winner. You could tell that because he made an O with his thumb and forefinger. No retakes. As I said, when it comes to the walk, I am a natural. The sit is immeasurably trickier. I was in three major movies yesterday, two Japanese, one American, and I had to stay in my chair at the café table in the corner of the Cathedral Square in Vence. It is an extremely picturesque corner of the old town, which is why it is extremely pictured. You cannot sit there for 2 minutes without a tourist pottering through with his camcorder on his shoulder, often jabbering excitedly into its integral mic. When I'm down here, as I am this week, I'm in the square most mornings. Same café, same table. I arrive around 11 a.m. to get the papers and the Grand Express, and a slug of something to scour the pipes. Now, it just so happens that in order to get the best shot of the square, you have to include me in it. In the old days of snapshotting and silent cine, this was a role so minor as to be irrelevant, indeed dispensable. Photo of medieval square, bloke reading the Times in corner, you either keep him in for the human touch, or you crop him out. Similarly with the old 8mm, if the bloke suddenly embarked upon some mood-reducing activity, such as picking his nose or slashing at a wasp with the business section, you could, when you got back to Yokohama, edit him out. But the camcorder has changed all that. Editing videotape is an exceedingly difficult business. Monkey see, monkey shoot, monkey more or less stuck with the result. Suddenly a new incumbency is placed upon the uninvited actor. He can make or break this movie. When the director is back home, about to premiere Herr Angenieur Müller fahrt nach Frankreich to a rapt neighbourhood audience, he may not want their attention distracted. He may not want his fascinating commentary on Romanesque facades interrupted by a query from the floor regarding the dingbat in the straw hat who has knocked his calvados into his trousers and begun shouting at God. Look how I upset the first Jap yesterday. As his lens panned through me, I raised my glass in cheery salutation. He stepped back from his tripod and glared furiously. Had he been remaking The Bridge on the River Kwai, one felt, he would have had me in the tin outhouse in less time than it takes to tell. In consequence, I sat stone-faced for his compatriot. For the cheery American, however, I raised my sombrero. He will be able to tell the folks back home that I am a local character. Cezanne's illegitimate grandson, perhaps. His local rotary will be knocked out. Which is why I need Rada if I'm to make something of myself. A Donald Sinden eyebrow, an Anthony Scher tick, a Derek Jacobi pout, these can take you right to the top in this business.
Bookends.
It has come, as it must always come on the last day of the holidays, with the suitcases yawning and those desquamating scales of tan we'd always planned to take home to England, but always knew we never should, drifting down like the first snowflakes of an early winter. What has come is the moment of half-truth. Do we take the books back with us? They're not what they were. They are read now, and being read on holiday is very different from being read at home, where they remain clean and flat, and all but indistinguishable from the state in which they left the booksellers, crisp as a starched dicky. On holiday, they get read good and proper. They don't half go through it. Here is Julian Barnes's Before She Met Me. It is swollen to twice its birth size, a gross grey wodge of a thing, still reeking of the chlorine into which it plunged before being fished out and baked in the sun. Marinated and done to a turn, it will, if I carry it home again, sit on the shelf, forever askew, silently recriminating. I shall not be able to look Julian in the eye again. Here is Fathers and Sons, lucky only in that Turgenev is no longer around to have my eye avoid his. I took it away to read again after 20 years, but I shan't be reading it a third time. Not all of it, anyhow, for whereas the Barnes has grown horribly fat, the Turgenev has grown horribly thin. Pages 132 to 144 are gone, I left it open one day when I went to lunch. It was a long lunch, which I took in the shade, but the book took in the gum-desiccating sun. When I got back, pages 132 to 144 had, quite literally, flown. They're probably in Bordighera by now, infuriating some bibliophiliac beachcomber. But how can I throw it away? It's a book, for God's sake. And so is the Russia House, though not, unhappily, exclusively. It is also an insecticide. It had the great misfortune to be the only hardback I took away with me, and it was therefore the weightiest object to hand on the bedside table when the thing came in. I didn't know what the thing was then, nor do I know what the thing is now, except that it's considerably flatter than it was then. It was the size of a thumb, and black, and scuttled up the wall on far more legs than one would ever have thought necessary just for getting about the place. And since it was not a thing you would want to turn the light out on, I grabbed the Le Carré without a second's thought and slammed it against the wall. I shall carry the crunch with me to the grave. But shall I also carry Le Carré? Cleverly, I had removed its dust jacket soon after we arrived, so that it wouldn't curl and crackle in the sun. The result of this is that I now have the ineradicable impress of a flattened thing on the front cover, caught forever in the instant of expiry, like those ghastly shadows left on Hiroshima walls. I feel queasy every time I look at it. Even if I put the spotless dust jacket back, I shall know that the thing is still there, a micron more palpable than its ghost, which will probably follow me around forever, hag-riding my soul like some figment of Poe, unless I lay it here, leaving the book behind. But not only is the Russia House a hardback, I haven't even read it yet. I had been saving it up. I had not anticipated that the day would come when I wouldn't even be able to touch it. Is the price of squeamishness to be another $12.95 back in London, or do I wait for the paperback? And as for Jolly Jilly Cooper, Rivals is more full of tiny bugs of its own than a Le Carré safehouse. Its 700 pages seem to have something midgy stuck to every margin. I blame my daughter, who, hooked inescapably on the fizzy plot, read straight through from cover to cover on one of those thundery midi days when the air is thick with mites. Dare we bring it back to England? Even in death, these tiny remains might be giving off stuff which could change our entire ecological structure. This, then, is the half-truth to whose moment I, standing here, have come. But why, in spite of all, do I really want to take these wrecks home? As soon as I find an answer, I shall pack.
Crickle ward, you stole my youth away. For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.
Cor Corran was written and read by Alan Corran and produced by Arid Evans.
For I was young and innocent, and you were old and grey.